Thank you.
Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Desitel Faculty of Management. Delighted to have this joint event between the faculties of medicine and management, and such a great crowd here today of young people. We're going to have the format today. We'll have two students here from the Desitel faculty having a conversation with Dr. Yunus for about 25 minutes or so. Then we'll turn over to questions from the audience. We'll be done around 11:30 or so. So that's the overall format. I'd first like to introduce two things. One is Dr. Yunus, but before is the McGill World Platform for Health and Economic Convergence. And this is something that Professor Dubay and her team started a few years ago now, and I think has had a very considerable impact. What it is an interdisciplinary initiative of the faculties of management and medicine here at McGill. It's rooted in the conviction that complex issues at the interface of health and economics can be resolved through integrated research and collaboration, interdisciplinary problem solving. So it's something which is, I think, unusual in the world and brings together a number of disciplines in a way which is having some very useful outcomes. And so we're delighted that Professor Dubay was very instrumental in bringing Dr. Yunus to McGill for this few days, and we very much appreciate her contribution. I'll go through Dr. Yunus's background in a moment, but first the two students will be interviewing him or conversing with him. Mike Ross is a lawyer here from Montreal who was a financial lawyer in London and New York, and then quit that occupation to run a peace negotiation project in Ramallah for a year, and then is in his final semester of his MBA. Celine Junk was born in Hong Kong. She also lived in Pakistan, Italy, and in Ottawa. Her father is a senior official at Canada's External Affairs, and so explains her growing up around the world. She's a leader here in the faculty, the president of the Management and Undergraduate Society, and she went on the trip, a bunch of us went on Abu Dhabi and Dubai, and so got to know her well, and she really is a young leader, and we'll see how where things go with her in the future. So delighted to have two of our student leaders here this morning. So Dr. Yunus is quite a phenomenal figure when you think about... it's probably better if he wasn't in the room when I introduced him. He's the founder and managing director of the Grameen Bank, which currently has 2,564 branches providing credit to 8 million poor people in 81,000 villages in Bangladesh. He developed the concept at the core of the Grameen Bank, which is banking without collateral to the poorest of the poor. So it is really astonishing to have someone that has helped tens, if not hundreds of millions, of the poorest people around the world with his ideas. So it's very inspiring. He studied economics in Vanderbilt, received his PhD in 1970. He taught economics at the Middle Tennessee University from 69 to 72. He returned to his native Bangladesh in 1972, joining the University of Chittagong as head of the economics department. I've been reading his book, which I very much recommend, on social business, and it's a very moving story how he saw the poverty in the villages around the university and felt moved in very difficult times in Bangladesh to try to help the poorest people. He was moved with compassion for people that really don't have a voice. He was born in 28th of June 1940 in the village of Bathra in the business center of what was then East Bengal. He was the third of 14 children, five of whom died in infancy. So he felt personally in his family some very, very difficult times. His father was a successful goldsmith who was always encouraged his sons to reach for a higher education. But his biggest influence was his mother, who always helped any poor who knocked on their door. This inspired him to commit himself to the eradication of poverty. He won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006 because of his great work for helping the poorest people among the world. So someone who is an inspiring example and shows the power of ideas. So I'll turn it over to Celine and Mike now for their questions, conversation. In about 20, 25 minutes, we'll have time for Q&A from the audience. So, Celine?
Hello? Okay. So, as Professor Moore explained, once Bangladesh gained its independence in 1971, you felt compelled to be part of the country's development. Was there anything in particular that really motivated you to help the underprivileged?
Well, Bangladesh means underprivileged, so so you have no other option to but to go do this thing. And I was never planning to stay in the States, so I was just waiting for me to finish the work and then go back. And in 1971, the War of Liberation began, so that delayed my departure. As soon as the war was over, I made sure that I go back. But by that time, it was a devastated country because a lot of killing, a lot of bloodshed, a lot of destruction. And when the war was over, it lost many lives, infrastructure and so on. Economies was in a total shambles. But I went back and I started doing what I always wanted to do, teach. I was teaching before I came to the States, and I went back and I started teaching again. And always I took the economics because I thought this is one way to understand the problems of the people. So that's what brought me back into the university. But then we had a big difficulty with our economy to start up, and it went down rather than going up. So we had a famine in the country. So that's when I felt terrible that I teach all those beautiful theories of economics in the classroom, but world outside is so different. It doesn't somehow follow the things that we talk about in the classroom. So I thought something is wrong in what I teach. So I wanted to get away from it, see if personally, as a human being, I can be of some use to other people. So that's what I was doing next door to the university campus. Our university is a new university. It's located right in the middle of villages. It's not an urban-based university. So it was easy for me to go out and be with the people in the village. And that's what I was trying to do.
And sort of just to follow up on that point, you talk about in the book quite a lot about the sort of planting seeds of change. And so, you know, you began just helping individuals and then went from there to build the bank. Do you think that for all of us, we all have within us, I guess, two things really, the ability but also the responsibility to make that sort of change, to sort of plant those individual seeds and hope that great things grow from them?
The point I was making that when I did little things in the village, I was not expecting to change the country or change anything. I was just trying to see if I can make a change in one individual. If I have done that, I thought I could use my capacity to help somebody. So all I have to do is to repeat it to reach out to this next one and the next one. So I took it as simple as that, as a kind of bite-sized problem. I was not overwhelmed by the problem, national problem. When you talk about national problem, it becomes aggregated. And because so overwhelming, you don't want to think about it, you don't want to get involved with it. It's so big. It's a small thing. If I can do it, I can do any time. So this is a small thing. And about anybody, I think each individual is equipped with the unlimited capacity, but we never address that capacity. We have it, but somehow it remains unexplored, unutilized, because the way we design our life, we are told generally, you say, well, work very hard, study hard, and get a good degree, and get a good job. And as if that's the kind of thing we say. So if I'm using my capacity only to do that, the fact that I can change the world with my capacity, that was never touched. So what I was suggesting that maybe we should address that I have that capacity. I can change the whole world. Not because I can go and do the whole world, but I can start something of a process which changes somebody, one person. If it changes one person, I have discovered the seed of change. If I've discovered the change, the seed of the change, then this can be replicated. This can be planted again and again. It can be a whole field and whole plantation of those seeds. So this is what I'm saying. You don't have to go and do it yourself. You start the process and demonstrate that it can be done. And we can do many things like that. Again, this is a bite-sized problem. So we don't see the bite-sized problem. In the classroom, we're always talking about the global problem. So many people die every day. So what am I supposed to do? If I know somebody dies in my neighborhood, I can save one life. I would do that. I'll try. At least I'll give it a try. Best shot. But if I can find a way to save one life, I found something. Either I'll do it, repeat it myself, or somebody say, hey, I can do it too. And my friend will do it, my neighbors will do it, and we'll save a lot of lives. And in the process, we found a way how to do that. So the process, for me, is the most important thing, how you do that. And anybody, any one of us can do if we put it in our mind.
All right. Moving on to the Grameen Bank. A distinctive feature is that 97% of the borrowers are women. How did this come to be, and what was your largest challenge achieving this percentage?
Okay. Again, this came as a part of the kind of funny thing that we're doing. We're trying to convince the bank to lend money to the poor people in the village because I just did it with my own money, and it created such an excitement in the village. So I thought I should make it a more regular feature. And one thought came to my mind, why don't I go to the bank and tell them that they can lend the money? People don't have to go to the loan sharks to do that. And I thought, it's such a simple solution, it will be done. Bank will not mind doing it because such a small amount of money involved. So when I talked to the bank immediately said, it's impossible, it cannot be done. So I didn't give up on that. I kept on arguing with them, and I started criticizing them in harsh languages. And I also joked with them. I said, look, yours is a very funny organization. You built a whole institution to lend money to people, but you lend money to people who already have money. But you are supposed to lend money to people who don't have money. You don't do that. You do the other way around. So I said, it doesn't make sense to me. So why don't you reverse it? Why don't you lend the money to the people who don't have the money? Of course, they didn't pay any attention. Then I also accused them that not only they reject the poor people, they reject all women of all types. It's not just the poor women, even the richest women. I said, your institution is a very discriminatory organization. So you deliberately avoid doing that. So that created a lot of debate with me. And I showed them the actual statistics that they have produced. Not even 1% of their borrowers happen to be women. I said, how do you justify that? Then they explained that they don't come. I said, no, they do come, but your rules are so different. If a woman comes to borrow from you, you always ask her, have you discussed with your husband? If she says, yes, I have discussed with my husband, then the manager will always say, why didn't you bring your husband along? We will talk about it in Monday. You come at 4 o'clock. I said, do you ever ask a man when he presents his proposal? Have you discussed it with your wife? Why didn't you bring your wife along and we'll discuss this? So it's a kind of a system which doesn't work for women. So that became a big battle, another issue. So when I began finally offering myself as a guarantor, I said, okay, I'll become a guarantor. I'll sign all your papers and I take the risk and you give the money. Finally, that worked after several months. So I wanted to make sure half the borrowers in my program are women. So this is the first idea of having women into the thing, because I was talking so loudly and aggressively against the policies of the banks. So I wanted to amend it myself and demonstrate it can be done. When I did that with my students with me, the women always said, no, don't give the money to me. I don't know how to use the money. I have no idea. You give the money to my husband. He's the one who handles money. We said, no, we are not giving to your husband. We are going to give it to you. I said, no, I don't want to touch money. I don't want to create trouble for my family. Because they always related money as a problem, as creating problem for the family. So something will go wrong. Because she's always scared she may offend somebody in the family. Because as a girl, she grew up being apologetic to everybody that she is a girl. Sorry. Because everybody said you brought misery to the family because you are a girl. So she is always mindful that she doesn't annoy anybody anyway. So she is a product of all kinds of fears that have been created around her. So we didn't take this answer that we don't want to take the money because we can't handle it. I explained to my students that it's not her voice. It is the voice of the history which produced her. So we have to peel off the fear layer by layer as Year after year, she has accumulated all those layers. And finally, when she's successful, one of them will come out and say, maybe I should try. And this is the first time she's expressing her courage. And if she's successful, it will impact on other women in the village. And some other two or five will come back, and they will do it. If they're successful, and more will come. So snowball effect will happen. And it took us 6 years to make it happen. And then we saw money going to the family through women brought so much more benefit to the family than the same amount of money going to the family through men in every single case. Because a woman, when she earns money, immediately benefit goes right to the children. It never fails. You don't see that immediately with men. And the money you give to her, whatever little money is, about $30 or $50, that's about the money that she borrows. She brings all her capacity to manage scarce resources and her management skill on that money so that she gets the best mileage out of that money. Men never had that skill because he never bothered to manage anything carefully. So he does it in a very casual way. So his accomplishment with that money is much less than the women does. And women always had a longer kind of vision. She wants to get off the kind of situation she is as fast as she could. But men, again, wanted to enjoy right away rather than wait for tomorrow. So seeing all these differences between men and women, we said, why don't we concentrate on women? Because it brings so much more benefit to the family. So that's how we started concentrating. And the result, we have now 97% women. And throughout the world, wherever we work, it became 100% women.
I'd like to pick up on something that you referred to just now, which is sort of the bank was refusing to lend, you know, the poor people. And reading about the Grameen Bank, one of the things that seems like a fundamental principle is the principle of trust. Right? You trust that people will pay it back. There's no collateral. It's just a faith in them. Now, from our perspective, certainly in the developed world, there doesn't seem to be that type of trust or faith in people. Do you think that that's something that we can regain? Do you think it's actually lost? Or is it just something that's sort of been... You know, it hasn't been used properly.
Several things. When we began, we had no other option but to trust them. Because they don't have anything to offer you as collateral or anything. So we said, forget about those collateral because it doesn't going to work for us. So we tried to develop some kind of relationship that let's do it in a way that we can work together. And we started explaining this, what is being done, later on. At that time, we didn't even know what is a trust or something. Just simply doing it, something we thought, this is the way it would work. And it worked out. And people started saying, hey, how does it work? You don't have collateral. What do you have? Then they said, oh, it must be cultural collateral. Because they cannot forget the word collateral. See? Mm-hmm. They have to have some place, because after all, you're doing banking. So I said, look, we don't have that. So they tried a lot of different things using that collateral thing. I said, no, there is nothing. People said, basically, it's a mutual trust. It's a mutual trust. So we continued, and they said, yes, that's a kind of, they trust us, we trust them. Otherwise, all the money that we give out, what is it that we expect that something will come back? Many people ask us, what if all the borrowers decide not to pay you back? I said, I have no recourse at all. Then somebody said, can you sleep peacefully at night? I said, I have very peaceful sleep. I have no problem. Because every day they're doing it. You are the one raising that question, if they don't do it. Right. Why should I worry about something which never happened? So let's look at the thing as it happens. And I don't see any way that everybody will decide to stop paying you back on a certain day. I cannot expect that. They are doing it over and over, years and years. So it's not a thought in my mind. Then I started saying, I said, look, the word credit means trust. That's what it came from. But that word is taken by the bankers and built a whole institution based on distrust. Because you bring your lawyers. Every time you lend money, your lawyers will give a stack of papers to be signed, co-signed, and notarized, and you name it, everything. I said, that's the first sign of your distrust. You are assuming that your customer or your client will run away with your money, and you are tying him down. In our case, we do the opposite. We give the money, no papers, nothing to be signed, it's yours. Do it and you'll turn it back. I said, in your case, probably if your repayment rate is, say, 95% or 98%, in 98% of the cases you are wrong because they paid back.
Right.
See? In our case, we have a trust. And in 98% of the time, they pay back. So we are correct. We trusted. In two cases, we didn't come out right because they didn't pay back. But again, in 2% that didn't pay back, it's not that they ran away with my money. Our loans are paid back in weekly installments. So, by 31st December, she's supposed to pay all this money. But she couldn't pay back three installments in the middle, so she will pay back this three installments in January. Doesn't mean that she ran away. So this is the 2% of the people who cannot complete the whole journey within the specified time. That's about 2%. That's it. So we are doing exactly what it is. You are the one who is making life miserable by bringing all those things. I know you're a lawyer.
Reformed.
So this is how the trust thing came. Now today you said, is it something in very special Bangladesh? People used to say, oh, it happens in Bangladesh. It will never happen to anybody anywhere else. It's a funny country anyway. All kinds of funny things happen there. I said, no, look, it's about the people. It's not Bangladesh or something. So we have been doing it all over the world, in the works. Now we work in New York City, exactly the same way. We have no collateral, nothing. We do exactly the same thing we do in the villages of Bangladesh. We do it in New York City. And we send people from Bangladesh to come and do it. And they were saying that, look, we've never been to the United States. How are we going to do it? I said, that's your advantage. You don't have to know about the United States. All you know is microcredit. You do exactly what you do. Go there and do it. Forget about that it's an American. So they do it and do it very well. They've been doing it since January 2008. It's a beautiful program. We have now over 4,000 borrowers, all women, 100%. We're not even 97%. It's 100% women. Average loan is about $1,500. And repayment rate is near 100%. It's 99.3%. So, see, it works anywhere. Yeah.
Your most recent book speaks of social business.
Yeah.
Could you explain to everyone in the room what it is and how it works?
It's a wonderful business. I hope you should get involved with it. You'll have a lot of fun. And we also say there are 7 principles of social business. And one of the principles is do it with joy. So it's having fun with that. It's basically taking business in another direction. The only business we all talk about, we do practice, we see around us, we are taught about that, is business to make money. Business means business to make money. Either work for that business and help the business to make money, or I run my own business to make money myself. I said, that's a very narrow interpretation of human being, that all that human beings do is make money. It doesn't sound right. I mean, human being is a much bigger an entity than just being a money-making machine. That's all we do from ever since we are born, trying to make money for ourselves. So I said, economists went wrong by interpreting human beings so narrowly. A huge, big entity has been squeezed into a very narrow role of making money. I said, and that has created all our problems around, because we have not handled human being in its proper perspective, in its proper role. I said, yes, economists took the selfishness in human being and built the whole theory of economics on top of it. I said, but human being is not all about selfishness. Human beings are selfish. This is one part of it, their dimension of life. There are many other dimensions, like selflessness is also part of human being. When something in Haiti happens, everybody rushes to help. Everybody writes checks, raise money to help people. This is not to make money. So how do you explain that? Economists tell you that, if you want to help, if you want to be philanthropist, step outside of economics, and then you'll be a philanthropist. Not in economics. I said, why is it? Isn't it supposed to be a social science? It's not supposed to be a science where you interpret me. Isn't it what you design something to fit me, rather than I transform myself to fit your theory? And now today, exactly what we're doing, we are fitting ourselves to their theory, so that we all look like good money makers. We are money makers, but no, we are not only money makers. That's the whole problem. I said, why don't you create a business on top of selflessness. You are a selfless being too. And it's something that to do things for other people, to make changes in other people's life, to help other people in a business way. So in a selfish business, everything is for me, nothing for others. In a selfless business, it will be the other side. Everything is for others, nothing for me. It's just selfless business. So I called it social business. I started making, I didn't define the business first. I already created those businesses. And then I say, maybe this is the kind of business which economics is missing. And then I realized that this is a whole part of human being, economics is missing. So I created this and called it social business and said, this business is a business which can be applied anywhere. If you have a problem, you solve it by a business formula. You apply your business idea and create a business out of it. And that's what I did. Whenever I saw a problem, instinctively I created a business. And that's why I created many, many such businesses. And I said, anybody can do that. It's such a simple thing. So this is the whole series of things that we have done, and many we have done. We have done something with Danone. Emmanuel Faber is sitting here. He's the CEO of Danone, Global Danone. And with his collaboration and the chairman of Danone, Frank Ribault, we created Grameen Danone Company to produce yogurt to solve the problem of malnutrition among the children of Bangladesh. Make this yogurt very cheap so that people can, poor people can have their children eat this yogurt and become a healthy child because we put all the micronutrients in that yogurt. So this is a social business. And we created other such businesses like a business of water. In another French company, Veolia, we have a joint venture with Veolia to produce clean water in the village and sell it to the people in the village because our water in Bangladesh is arsenic contaminated. So people literally drink poison every day. Their children drink poison every day. So you have that manifestation of poison in all of your body. Your skin is peeling off. It's all kinds of diseases in all your body. And people die of arsenic contamination. But nothing can be done because there is no help coming on their way. So they keep on drinking the same water. So we thought maybe we should create a social business to produce this water. And that's what we are doing. And there are many other companies now showing interest to come as a social business partner to bring water to the people, affordable way, and so on. We created a joint venture with Adidas. It's a big global company. We challenged them to address the issue of barefoot people, people who cannot wear shoes because they cannot afford it. They said, and since they cannot afford it, they don't wear shoes. As a result, they become victims of many diseases. Many diseases attack your body through the skin of your feet, like parasitic diseases. So many of these parasitic diseases attack them. And children become the victims, women become the victims. So we said, why don't we make shoes affordable to the poorest people? And after a lot of discussion, Adidas agreed to do that and asked me how cheap these shoes should be. I said, well, if you want to sell it to the poor people, it should be under €1. They were shocked that you have to sell shoes under €1 with Adidas or Reebok shoes. But finally, they accepted it, and they created with us a company to do that. And now, with 1.5 years down the line, they have studied, they have researched, they have designs, they have opinion surveys, and finally, they did the test marketing of the shoes, and people loved it. Kept the price very close to €1. And this is the beginning of that. And soon they will be coming with the mass production for these shoes so that everybody can afford it. So we have created such companies. We are doing something on healthcare. Healthcare is a big issue. And healthcare can be addressed in a social business in a brilliant way if you can apply the technology and the creativity so that healthcare can be delivered at home. Not in the clinic, not in the hospital, the way we have designed all the doctors and nurses waiting in the hospital, but nobody has the ability to come to the hospital and go through the whole process. I said it's a very simple thing today to bring the entire healthcare services at the house itself to the individual inside the home. She feels comfortable, she doesn't feel threatened, she doesn't have to make any appointments. And she goes through everything that you do because you can transmit all the information, all the diagnostic results right from home to the desk of the expert who is sitting wherever, either in Montreal or in Dhaka. Doesn't matter because distance is totally immaterial in this age. So why are you worrying about physically trying to go and do that? You can deliver the service. That's the interesting thing. So this is what the whole idea of social business, how we do that.
I guess at this point, do you have a last question, Celine?
I do have a last question. You mentioned joy being one of the seven principles.
Indeed. Yeah.
What makes you happy?
Doing more social business. Because that's where your happiness comes from. Yeah. You see, people say making money is the happiness, so people chase money, and the more money you make, the more happy you are. So it's the yardstick of happiness is the amount of money you've got. I said, you are totally wrong. Just being a billionaire doesn't mean you are the happiest person. You have so many other things to worry about that you worry that doesn't disappear from your life. So to identify the stack of money with the stack of happiness is a wrong kind of identification. I said, if you ever touch the life of another person, and you first time realize what a happiness is in by touching other people's life, that happiness cannot be measured by money. It's something comes from the inside. So when you get involved with social business, that's the happiness you get. More you touch the lives, more things that you come up with ideas to change everything in the world in favor of the people who are deprived from these things around the world, the more happy you get. So it's a competition between the happiness in touching lives and happiness in making money. Once you get involved with both, then you'll have a proper judgment. Today you cannot make a judgment because the only thing you know how to make money. You have not trust the other one. All you do is make donations, write checks for things, which brings you happiness in a kind of way, but you have not really been with the person who has benefited from your money. You gave that money to an NGO, to an organization who did something and reported back to you in a second-hand way. But if you're in the social business, you're in direct contact. You're in a day-to-day contact. And that transforms you completely. And excitement that it brings you is immeasurable. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mike and Celine. Among your many accomplishments, I've never seen Mike Ross blush before. Not quite a Nobel Prize, but
very
quite
good.
A compliment.
You should give me a prize for that.
So questions from the audience. So would anybody have any questions? Oh, sorry, the mics. Mel, could you come in, and Ron, if you could be so kind? So if you have a question, just raise your hand, and the mic will come your way. So there's a lady over here, Ron, in the back row.
Hi, Doctor.
Hi.
I'm very honored to hear your lecture. And I have a question that what is the belief behind to keep you on doing the social business? That is, I'm curious about where does your immense love to the poor come from? Thank you.
Well, it's, I would say, frustrations, desperations. If you live in a country like Bangladesh, it's very easy to accumulate these frustrations. Things you hope will change doesn't change. Things you hope will be different tomorrow is the same, more of the same. So you get frustrated. So you want to do something to overcome that frustration. Out of desperation, you do lots of desperate things. So these are the things that you did, and sometimes you're happy that it worked. So it makes you happy that, yes, this is the kind of thing you want to do. Then you can ask, why are you frustrated? Frustrated, as I said, you want to think that things will be different in your country, in your neighborhood, in your place, that will not cause you pain, that you have to see this again and again. And you try to overcome that. Nothing gets done, all those beautiful theories, all those beautiful actions and so on, promise that it will transform everything, doesn't transform anything. So you want to come up and say, can I do something? And you do, and if it works, you feel happy that at least in your case it worked.
Other questions?
Morning, Dr. Dunas. I have a question about, because I'm a business student, so I'm thinking about how to start a business. One of my concern is that when you lend money to the poor people, do they think about because they need to pay the interest. So is there one of the concerns to them? Because maybe before, if they borrow money from the friends, they don't need to pay the interest. But when they go to the bank, they need to pay the interest. Do they bother with this issue? Thank you so much.
Well, I wish they had a lot of friends who can give the money free to do that. But unfortunately, poor people don't have those kind of friends who will give money as freely as you thought. They become victims of the loan sharks. That's the usual way. And the loan shark practice is totally inhumane, the kind of squeeze they bring to the people. So what we are trying to do is to free people from the loan sharks so that they don't have to go to the loan sharks and give up everything in their life for the loan sharks. So we created an alternative way, in a more financial business way, so that you borrow money with a very reasonable interest rate compared to loan shark interest rate, compared to commercial bank interest rate. It's a reasonable. So you are very happy that when you compare the loan shark interest rate with the interest rate in a microcredit program, you almost look like it's free money. It doesn't make sense. Like in New York City, we do that. Same Grameen Bank work. But the whole place, whole New York City is filled with payday loans. I'm sure you are familiar or at least read about it. I hope you never borrowed from payday lenders. Payday, you open it in newspaper, you open it in television, they're advertising how easy to borrow money and how you just one step, you get the money, any amount you want, $300, $500, $1,000. You need desperately some money, so you go there. And what interest do you pay? 500%, 1,500% interest. And it's a thriving business all over the United States. I don't know, I'm sure it has some link here in Canada too. But that's the way they can survive. And you go anywhere, you see pawn shops. In America, it's very visible. Every city has a big sign with the pawn shops. This is another sign that people have to give up things just to borrow something. They put their valuables to the pawn shop and just to get a small amount of money. And since they cannot pay that back, that thing they have to lose control of. The ownership is gone. So this is the same. In the contrast of that, this is what we got. And the whole bank is owned by the borrower. So it's not somebody else taking away their money. So if the bank makes, when the bank makes profit, profit goes back to them. It's a total complete circle within that.
We have a question over here. First of all, thank you for being an inspiration to all of us.
Thank you.
I have a question. Last year, I saw a documentary about Grameen helping train women in Bangladesh to install solar panels mm-hmm. on the roofs of houses.
That's right.
And I thought it was a wonderful link between social sustainability and environmental sustainability.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I was wondering if you would be so kind and comment on how social and environmental sustainability goes hand in hand, especially in fragile environments like Bangladesh.
Yeah. Sure.
Thank you.
Yeah. What we did, as I said, when I see a problem, I create a business. This is another business that I created. And call it Grameen Shakti or Grameen Energy. Bangladesh doesn't have much of electricity. About 70% of the people do not have access to electricity. So it's a huge number. Bangladesh has something like 160 million people. So 70% of 160 million people is a lot of people don't have electricity. So you go around, people are burning kerosene just to get a dim light, and their children struggling hard to study. And that's how we grew up in the villages. We didn't have any electricity. We were just studying things in the lamp, trying to see things in a dim light. That's what millions of children do in the villages, and their families and so on, does everything in kind of semi-darkness kind of situation. So we thought this is an opportunity also to be taken in favor of solar energy, because Bangladesh is blessed with limitless sunshine. It's a country full of sunshine. So we thought, why don't we try to bring solar energy here? Since the vacuum exists, we can fill that vacuum and bypass the fossil fuel energy. So we created this company to bring solar home system, sell whole solar home system to the families. And everybody says it won't work, it's so expensive. People cannot afford to do that. So we came up with the idea how to make it easy for people to do that. And we made an installment payment, monthly installment you pay. It's a very small solar home system. You have four or five lights, bulbs in your house, which is enough for the whole house. And you can run a television so that you get connected with the whole world. So we are struggling at that time to sell five solar home systems a month. And we hope to achieve 100 solar home systems per month, because we thought such a grand ambition to sell 100 solar home systems. And we finally did it after many months. We hit that 100 and we celebrated that finally we made that. Today that's a history, because we sell over 1,000 solar home systems per day now. So it's a big thing. And so we are buying solar panels from all over the world, from Japan, from Germany, from China. And now we have decided to produce panels inside the country as a social business, so that we can bring down the cost of the panel. At the same time, we have plenty of supply ourselves. So two things we are trying to bring down. Today we buy it at the cost of about $2.50 per watt of the solar panel. We want to reduce it under $1 by producing it ourselves. And then also produce batteries. You need, for every solar home system, you need a battery. So we want to produce a battery in an environmentally friendly battery. This battery that we use now is not a very friendly battery. So we want to do the new technology that is coming up through the electric car and so on. Take that technology and build a factory as a social business to produce that battery and bring down the cost of the solar panel, so that we can sell 10,000 pieces or 20,000 pieces of solar home system every month, so that everybody can afford it. So that's what we are moving in that direction. And I think if we can bring down the cost of solar panel under $1, every home in Bangladesh will be run by solar home system, because it makes so much sense compared to the cost of kerosene and everything else. And it's so health friendly, because fume of kerosene is not a very good thing for your respiratory system.
Hi, Dr. Yunus. Hi. My name is Derek, and my question relates into the idea that today we see an increasing awareness and impact of social business ideas, and still people are framed in the perspective that they can only either work in the social sector or in the business world, and they have to study in those areas and work in those areas. So, like, what's the next step for social business on a global level to change this mindset?
One, we are discussing today at this university also to bring it within the university as a part of academic understanding. Because unless we discuss it in the classroom, unless it is in the textbook, it doesn't get to our head. It becomes a kind of casual discussion and so on, because we were trained that this is the business in the classroom. And we go out and say they're social business. We cannot absorb it because we have not fitted into our system. Because mindsets are created in the classrooms. When you come out as a different person, because your mind is now has a different kind of mold set by the courses you took, teachers that you was taught by. So they helped you create your own mindset. Once your mindset is done, it's very difficult to undo that mindset. It's very difficult to absorb that thing. So this process of education is very important. So all these inputs has to be inside that process. Then you start feeling that, yes, this is what I can do. If young people learn in their classroom that there are two kinds of business in the world. One is to make money for myself or my shareholders, or I can change the world, or I can solve the problem. It's up to me to decide which way I want to go. So you'll be deciding which way you want to go. Like for MBAs, for example, I'm saying today's MBAs are trained so that you can go out and join a company and give your talent, your creativity, your expertise that you learn from the school to make money for their shareholders. And so you dedicate your life to do that. I said, why don't we have another department side by side, which will be giving you social MBA. You'll be trained how to design a social business, how to run a social business, how to measure the impact of the social business, what are the problems that you should be addressing through a social business, what are the things done as a social business, what still can be done because it's difficult. Then you say, hey, it's not difficult. I can create something like that. I would like to do solve this problem. I will crack. I'll have a crack at that. So they will feel I can use my talent in changing the situation of the whole world. So this part is missing. As I said, why don't you bring it in so that we can discuss that? Only then you will see you have an option. Today you have no option. All you can do, either you run a business or you work for a business. That's a very uninteresting life. The other one is very interesting life.
I'm afraid we just have one last question. So.
I know you didn't like that. That's why you want to close it. Thank you.
It's not that often I get made fun of by a Nobel Prize winner, so I feel honored somehow.
Thank you.
So, first of all, as several students have said already, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Today, it's been a wonderful experience this morning. I was wondering, you spoke quite a bit about trust relationships and therefore having no need for collateral, and I think you're right in saying that that's a fairly foreign concept to many of us here. And I was wondering if you could comment a little bit more on the details of how that process works, how you build trust with your clients or your customers before lending them any money.
Well, what we did, we tried to develop a relationship between the bank and the person. One basic principle that we started out right from the beginning, that people should not come to the bank, banks should go to the people. So all the work we do, wherever we work around the world, the same principle. Nobody has to come to our office. For them, office is immaterial, it's non-existent. We work to do the business at your place, so we come to you. So this is one basic principle. Another thing we did, if someone wants to borrow money, she says, I would like to take a loan from you. We said, okay, tell me where you live. I'll note down, I'll get and make an appointment with you. I'll come to your home so that we can discuss business. Because we don't want to discuss business in an office, on the street, or anywhere. We'll always discuss business at your home. So I'll make an appointment and come to your home. And we are always looking for the poorest person. And you already explained to me that you are poorest person. That's why we agreed to meet at your home. The moment I come to your home, looking at your home, I know that you are not the poor person that I would thought that you would be. So I look around and said, well, you are definitely not a very high-income person, but I'm sure there are people who are not as lucky as you are around your place. Like you have two rooms in your house. We are looking for one-room people. Can you guide me to anybody who lives in one room? She said, yeah, we have several people here. So, okay. She becomes a guide for me. She takes me around. She doesn't feel bad because literally there are many others. We said, you'll come to it after we have done the one-room people. So we go to the one-room people. And we look around. We see that she has a bed and she has a chair or something. We said, okay, you are in difficult situation, but we are looking for people who do not have any furniture inside the home. So if you find somebody, let's go and talk to them. So this is gradually we're trying to reach out to the poorest person. Once we find her, and then we ask her to find four other friends like her if she is interested in borrowing money from Grameen Bank. Usually the answer she will give you when after you give the whole spill over Grameen Bank, this is what we'll do, this is what we can do. She will always say, no, thank you, I don't need any money, I have to carry on my life like this, I cannot handle money. And we, in our training classes, we tell our staff in our training that if the answer is like that, that no, I don't need money, I have to handle my life in my own way, we tell the person that she is the one we are looking for. You found the person, now you have to work with her to build the confidence in her so that someday she will agree, say, let me try some. And then she will be asked to find four other friends like her so that they are equal. So become a group of five. So that group of five becomes the nucleus for our activity. We will work through that group all the time. So they will elect a chairperson of the group, a secretary of the group, and any loan. If I want to take a loan, I don't go to the bank to talk about it. I talk to my chairperson. I said, I need a loan of this amount for doing this. And she said, okay, we'll have a meeting and we'll discuss this. So she will convene the meeting of the five and discuss this. And they will ask me very tough questions. Why do you need so much money? You can do this with this money. You don't need all that money. And after all those discussion, finally they will approve, say, okay, we'll recommend this to the bank. So this is how the bank is get involved. And we'll meet these groups every week at their place and do the business at their place. So we become part of a family. We don't see it as a kind of business somewhere else. And it makes it easy for us because they own the bank. So they don't feel an outsider. We are the employees. They are the owners. So that's kind of another kind of relationship that we build up. So that becomes a family kind of an environment rather than a customer business kind of relationship. So that's how the whole system works. And we become interested in her well-being, about her health. Normally, banks will not be interested in the health of the family or the health of the person. We do. And we are also interested in the children of the family. We want to make sure the children go to school. So this is part of our job. All our staff is required to make sure 100% of the children of those families that serve go to school. So this is an important element for us. So this is another outside the banking thing that we do. And there is something called 16 decisions in Grameen Bank. If you look at the 16 decision, you'll realize how much diversified our interest is for each person, that these are the things one has to accomplish. And loan is a kind of excuse or entry point to make all these things, other things happen. And this is how we build up the relationship. So the relationship is not just one loan and paid you back, thank you, I'm done with you. It's not like that. It's a relationship, a permanent kind of relationship that we build up.
Well, Dr. Yunus, this is perhaps a great university at its best. We expose young people, the future, to great ideas that have changed the world. Microcredit has changed the world of many, many poor people. We hope millions of more, hundreds of millions in the future. We have this another new idea of social business. And I guess the challenge to the faculty, I heard, my fellow faculty and to the students is, how do we take social business on all, not into the business school so much as into the world? Yeah. So the challenge is for many of you, how do you consider his idea of social business and say, how do I, as a young person with many decades ahead of me, how do I change the world? We've seen someone who's changed the world through the power of ideas. Started off very small, and he was very fortunate to have it grow very large. Okay. But what ideas can we take forward? That's the challenge. And I look forward to interacting with students to find out what you do in the many years to come. So, Dr. Yunus, a small token of our appreciation, if I could present that to you. Just a wonderful talk, and thanks for your time
today.
Thank
you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay.
So, can I get the photo before you?
Yeah, okay, why not? Let's do that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.